Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. They are everywhere now. Werewolves, vampires, zombies. Crack open a new book and there they are, mauling, howling, sucking, gobbling, making monster whoopee. What is it with us and monsters these days, with blood and fangs and fur? This hour on Point, werewolves, zombies, and the old fantasies, horrors, pouring into new fiction. You can join the conversation. Is that you with a werewolf under the covers in a book? A vampire? A zombie? Why? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear today from a literary pro who's taken up the monster genre in The Last Werewolf, and from a newbie writer, a doctor, bringing us the zombie autopsies. But first, joining me from New York is Alexandra Alter, arts and culture reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's written about this season's superabundance of supernatural fiction. Alexandra, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What's going on here? Give us a sense of just how omnipresent this stuff has become.
It's amazing. There's this really interesting movement brewing in literary circles where novelists from across the spectrum are experimenting with science fiction and fantasy themes. It's been happening for a while now with authors like Margaret Atwood and Cormac McCarthy playing with science fiction in their novels, but it seems to be reaching a whole new level this year. Some of the books, as you mentioned in your introduction, are really featuring robots, witches, zombies, werewolves, ghosts, time travel, and they're kind of blurring the line between literary fiction and genre fiction in a really interesting way. And they're mostly aimed at a really broad audience, not just at your typical science fiction and fantasy fans.
And it's not just down and dirty. It's not just the old sort of hack paper book genre at all here. We're going to hear in just a minute from Glenn Duncan. He wrote The Last Werewolf. The Independent says it is a sublime study in literary elegance. It is bloody and brilliant. So the two are getting fused up here.
Exactly. And some of these new books are challenging assumptions in the literary world about what constitutes high and low art. It's interesting because this divide between literary and genre fiction wasn't always there. A lot of fantasy fans like to point out it was a pretty recent innovation with the modernists who were sort of opposed to plot and narrative and wanted their books to be hyper-realistic. But if you go further back, you know, to pillars of the literary canon, writers like Homer and Dante and Milton and Shakespeare, up through Mary Shelley, these writers blended realism and supernatural elements really seamlessly, and it seems like we're moving back in that direction now towards fiction that can be both realistic and fantastical.
Well, take us across the mountain range there. I mean, you had The Passage, vampire epic last summer, Justin Cronin's book. You had The Discovery of Witches, Deborah Harkness. But what's coming?
Well, there's a ton coming this summer, and particularly in the fall. You mentioned Glenn Duncan, and he has a fantastic werewolf novel starring a suicidal werewolf who drinks scotch and chain smokes and is incredibly erudite, so it's not your usual werewolf. Another well-established literary author who's moving in this direction is Tom Perata. He's coming out this August with a dystopian novel. It's set in a small town in the aftermath of the Rapture, where millions of people have instantly vanished. And it's a huge departure for him. He's previously written these quiet family dramas, and suddenly he's playing with this high concept. His publisher is hoping that it's going to reach a whole new audience for him beyond the literary fiction fans he usually draws.
You quote you quote Lev Grossman, who wrote The Magician King, saying, "We are the mainstream. Literary fiction, I guess the old style, is a subculture now."
Yes, he has an interesting take on this whole movement, and he has a book coming out actually this summer as well. It's a sequel to his bestseller, The Magicians, and the book centers on a group of 20-something New Yorkers with magical powers. He's a really good example of this new generation of fantasy writers because he's been compared to both J.K. Rowling, the creator of Harry Potter, and the literary novelist Jay McInerney. So you can see how he's really fusing those two worlds.
The payoff can be enormous here. You remind us, Charlene Harris, her vampire novels, they came, they spawned the HBO series True Blood. They sold nearly 21 million copies.
Exactly. She's a constant on the bestseller list, and publishers have certainly taken note. They've gotten really excited by these recent successes. I mean, in addition to Charlene Harris, you have Twilight and Harry Potter, which have had astronomical sales and turned into successful movie franchises. I think the Twilight series has sold 116 million copies. Harry Potter has sold more than 450 million copies, which in publishing is just massive. And one of the reasons these books succeeded, besides the movies, which certainly helped, is that they crossed over to multiple audiences. They attracted teenagers and kids and adults and men and women. And publishers who, as you probably know, have been facing declining print sales, mm-hmm. are really looking for crossover hits like this that can, you know, resonate with a broad group of readers.
You remind us, even established literary figures, Cormac McCarthy, Margaret Atwood, Philip Roth, Michael Chabon, experiment with science fiction tropes like alternate history, post-apocalyptic civilizations. But here's Glenn Duncan with The Last Werewolf. We'll hear from him in just a minute from the UK. Brought out by Knopf, which is, you know, they published Nabokov and Updike. What is it? I mean, even Knopf, they're ready to go down the werewolf vampire train now?
They are, and it's interesting. These typically genre fiction has had sort of its own literary subculture. There are specific imprints for science fiction and fantasy that market their books towards those specific readers. But now mainstream publishers are looking for these types of books. They've seen how successful they can be, how many copies they can sell, and with authors like you mentioned. We talked about Margaret Atwood and Cormac McCarthy. Mm-hmm. Colson Whitehead is another author who is going to have a zombie book coming out this October. So when you have these, extremely well-established literary authors who are suddenly going in a more commercial direction, it's really a dream for publishers.
Flash in the pan or lasting trend?
That's an excellent question. It seems to be a lasting trend.
Oh, my gosh.
It seems to be growing, and it seems to be a constant on the bestseller list.
The werewolf is moving in. Alexandra Alter with The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to hear in a moment from Stephen Schlossman. He's out with The Zombie Autopsy. He's a doctor looking at what might be going on inside those zombies. But in just a second, we're joined by Glenn Duncan in the UK. His new book, getting great reception, is The Last Werewolf. And there's a CD that's come out alongside it. This is from the band The Real Tuesday Weld, kind of tuning in to his themes around the book. Let's listen.
Dear little girl, just a bite, and you will be consumed with delight.
Oh, Mr. Wolf, my hunger is real, but they say there's more to love than a meal.
The old and upright, what do they know? I'm all appetite, you'll help me to grow.
Oh, my love, I want you to, but my desire may prove your doom. You have the thing.
Great reviews and a band kicking in a soundtrack. What novelist would argue with that? Joining me now from Plymouth, England, is Glenn Duncan, hip British author of 7 well-received novels. His latest, The Last Werewolf, goes full-on into Monsterland. Like, says The Guardian, an updated version of Dracula, only for werewolves, and as rewritten by Bret Easton Ellis. In its own blood-crazed and sex-dazed way, says The Guardian, The Last Werewolf makes the case for literature. Glenn Duncan, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
I've read you saying that bringing a werewolf in was the smartest thing you've ever done. Why?
It was, I suppose, I'm really crediting myself with more savvy than I really had. It's a retrospective act of rationalization and self-congratulation because it was pretty much accidental. It turns out that it was a very good move. It began, I have to be truthful, as a fairly mercenary decision. The 7 previous novels that you've just alluded to,
yes.
All of which were overtly literary novels. The 7th one of those, which was a sort of post 9/11 kind of semi-political literary novel, mm-hmm. fared exactly as its 6 predecessors, which by which I mean that not enough people read it and it didn't win a prize. So when I had a conversation with my agent and said, look, if I write the logical successor to this novel, do you think you'll find a buyer for it? And he said, no.
Oh, no.
Werewolves
howling right there, Glenn.
Yeah. So in a fit of pique, I decided to go away and write. The intention was to write a straight commercial genre novel. No mm-hmm. philosophy, no existential angst, no sort of moral inquiry, just a straight page-turning narrative. What happened was that very quickly, when I began writing the novel and started with this central character, it became luminously obvious that this was a great vehicle for writing about all the things that I wanted to write about anyway.
Someday we'll pay back all we've borrowed. What we love today, we'll lose tomorrow. But I won't need to wait for my share of sorrow, 'cause I always kill the things I love. I won't need to wait for my share of sorrow, 'cause I always kill.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about werewolves, zombies, and the old fantasies, horrors, pouring into new fiction. You can join the conversation this hour. What is it about this terrain that makes books sell like hotcakes? What is it with werewolves, blood, the gothic, the desire to be in fantasy land, zombies? Is real life not enough? Is it too much? Have you read the raves for Glenn Duncan's The Last Werewolf? Are you ready for the zombie autopsies? Glenn Duncan joins us today from Plymouth in the UK, author of I, Lucifer and The Last Werewolf, getting pretty great reviews. Steve Schlossman joins us in a moment with his The Zombie Autopsies. Let's get a caller right here. Stand by, Glenn Trey in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on with Glenn Duncan, werewolf writer.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Glenn. I was just listening to the question you asked at the beginning about why people are turning to these sort of fantastical ideas and novels and movies. And I don't know, I just had an off-the-wall theory, and I don't know if it's valid or not. Maybe
let's hear it.
Tell me. I was just thinking that I could be wrong, but Superman, I think, when Superman first started, it was like in the Depression. It was very popular. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if it was related to the economy, the state of the economy, and if people are more likely to turn to a more fantastic type of novel or movie to help them escape, I guess, a reality that maybe isn't ideal for everyone right now.
Great question. Great premise. Mr. Duncan, what do you say?
Well, I think that, I mean, really the shift that's occurred is not so much that more people are reading supernatural fiction or fantasy fiction. It's that the market for supernatural and fantasy fiction has always been there, but it's been very rigidly defined in terms of what its parameters are. It's been very clearly identified as genre fiction, just like crime thrillers and so on. I think that what's happened as a result of some of the recent phenomenal successes with, Charlene Harris books and Stephanie Meyer, mm-hmm. Is that writers who wouldn't normally be thinking of writing in that mode, it's been brought to their attention, partly in a very sort of obvious and practical way, in that lots of people are reading them. You travel on the Underground in London, and it appears that reading one of these books has become sort of globally mandatory. So I think what's happening at the moment is that you're just seeing a rising interest in the form, or at least in the material of the supernatural, from writers who wouldn't necessarily normally address it.
Well, there's definitely more interest. And I mean, I don't know about the UK. In the US, the numbers of books with this stuff in them, it is just visibly going up. And you look at the sales numbers, they're enormous, as you say, with Charlene Harris, Stephanie Meyer, and many more. And yet, as you say at the same time, Glenn, these are coming into the hands of a kind of writer who might not have picked them up before. I wonder if you'd read, just to give us a flavor of how that shows up in You're the Last Werewolf, I wonder if you'd read just a little bit of, for us here. And you should set this up a little bit, because we talk about WoCop. This is the outfit that's out trying to, what, kill off the ghouls, the werewolves, shows up in the middle of this, and your hero, or anti-hero, Jake, the werewolf who's world-weary, is in their sights. But he's got a very philosophical kind of take on where he stands as a werewolf. Could you read a bit for us?
Sure. All paradigm shifts answer the amoral craving for novelty. Obama's election victory did it. So did the Auschwitz footage in its day. Good and evil are irrelevant. Show us the world's not the way we thought it was, and a part of us rejoices. Nothing's exempt. One's own death sentence elicits a mad little hallelujah, and mine's egregiously overdue. For 10, 20, 30 years now, I've been dragging myself through the motions. How long do werewolves live? Around 400 years. I don't know how. Naturally, one sets oneself challenges. Sanskrit, Kant, advanced calculus, Tai Chi. But that only addresses the problem of time. The bigger problem of being just keeps getting bigger. Vampires, not surprisingly, have an on-off love affair with catatonia. One by one, I've exhausted the modes. Hedonism, asceticism, spontaneity, reflection, everything from miserable Socrates to the happy pig. My mechanism's worn out. I don't have what it takes. I still have feelings, but I'm sick of having them, which is another feeling I'm sick of having. I just don't want any more life.
Glenn Duncan reading from The Last Werewolf. Do not be confused. There's plenty of life in here, and sex and lust and gore and the whole works. Did you have to read up on werewolves, Glenn, to figure out, you know, what they were and what would make sense in a werewolf book?
I always wish I could answer this question by saying yes. I spent 6 months studying at the Institute of Werewolf Studies in Alaska, but unfortunately such a place does not exist, although perhaps it's only a matter of time before there is such a place. No, I mean, I basically consulted my own memories from childhood, growing up watching those great Hammer horror movies of the 60s and 70s. And some of the ones that have come after. So, I have an idea of a werewolf, which is probably not that different from very many other people's, at least in terms of, you know, what the defining characteristics are, the full moon and the silver bullets and so on. But other than really consulting my own hunches and instincts and sort of, you know, tapping into what people generally think of by when they think of a werewolf, no special research whatsoever.
And yet, on the whole thing comes, let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. And Donna. Donna, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air with Glenn Duncan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In answer to the question about why the genre has resurfaced, because it's certainly been popular in the past, I think J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter series has really made it, has created the interest in it. I qualify as a senior adult. And I just thoroughly enjoyed reading her books and found her creativity in creating this fantasy world for wizards and witches, and, you know, the idea of establishing an academy for the best and the brightest, to train the best and the brightest. And she created a vocabulary. She created a whole world.
Did it make a bridge, Donna? Did it make a bridge for you? Did you walk right out of Harry Potter and into vampire books and maybe werewolves and zombies?
Well, I always liked the genre. I liked the Anne Rice books very much, and I always kind of liked them. And then it had fallen off. I just really wasn't interested there for a while, and then. A couple summers ago, I hurt my back, and my daughter bought me the first of the Harry Potter books, and so that I could recuperate, and I was just absolutely hooked.
The next thing you know, there's a wizard at the door and maybe a vampire in your next book. Glenn Duncan, how about it? I mean, J.K. Rowling sold 400 million copies of those Harry Potter books. That's a pretty big signal.
Yes, wealthier than the Queen, I'm told.
Good heavens.
But yes, I suppose it is. I mean, there are periodically these sort of publishing phenomena, and that was certainly the one that made the biggest mark on the map in terms of units sold. And I think, I mean, I haven't read the Harry Potter books, and to be truthful, I don't read much genre fiction myself, mm-hmm, although I'm mm-hmm. a big horror movie fan. But again, as I say, I think it's just that, you know, the hunger for escapist fiction and escapist narratives is perennial. I mean, you can go back as far as you like in terms of storytelling and even pre-narratives that are before writing was around, just oral narratives. They've all reflected a desire to venture imaginatively into the realms beyond the here and now. So it's an old and healthy appetite, I think, that is part of the human imagination. The difference is just, as I say, that at the moment, I think writers who wouldn't normally, be going near there are starting to become interested.
No kidding. I mean, we can't imagine. At least it's hard for me to imagine, I don't know, John Updike or Nabokov or Kingsley Amis or Martin Amis dropping a werewolf into their pages, but you've done it. I mean, the Observer looks at in all of your work, it says you write about the subjective and nebulous nature of good and evil, the frailty of human morality. But who would have thunk it when you began, Glenn, that you'd end up having a furry werewolf in the middle of that?
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, even with Updike, you've got the Witches of Eastwick, for example. You know, so
yeah,
there are precedents among literary writers.
Yeah.
And you know, people, the most common question that I've been asked is, well, why werewolves? And increasingly my answer is becoming, well, why not? When you find out what writing about the supernatural or kind of archetypal or mythic figures like the werewolf or the vampire or the monster of some kind, the outsider, when you start to write and find the fertility of that as a ground for exploring the ideas that you know, literary writers are perpetually preoccupied with, it's not so surprising. I mean, it's a bit like saying, so, Mr. Kafka, you know, an insect, why?
it's
coming at the question from the wrong angle, I think.
Jake Marlowe is your werewolf. He's witty. He's jaded. Quoting him here, he says in your book, two nights ago, I'd eaten a 43-year-old hedge fund specialist. I've been in a phase of taking the ones no one wants. He's a raconteur. Julie in Westford, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think, speaking to the topic of escapism and good versus evil, I think one of the additional keys to why the popularity is growing in regards to werewolves and, you know, vampires and all of those,
mm-hmm.
you know, those, what we always thought of as demons and evil monsters, I think in today's world, maybe we're questioning now more than ever how we quantify the good versus the evil and how we identify who the good guy is and who the bad guy is. I think that at a kind of a subconscious level that's tying into it.
Are we more afraid now, Julie? Is this reflecting a kind of fear about, you know, boogeyman and monsters under the bed and, I don't know, chemicals in the water and heat in the air? Do you see a connection?
I don't think we're more afraid, but we're not sure we can identify who the bad guy is anymore, right? Because all those, you know, finely dressed nice people really aren't so fine and nice, right? And so they're the werewolves, potentially, right? So I think that, you know, we're forced to question how we quantify and qualify people as good versus evil. I think that's a good thing, and I think that kind of forcing it into a fictional environment where we're talking about traditional monsters, but maybe they're not, makes us question how we otherwise judge what we took as assumptions.
Yeah, as a given. Deconstructing right there into vampire, werewolf, zombie land. Glenn Duncan, how about it? In your book, do non-werewolf humans have a monopoly on morality?
No, absolutely not. And I mean, to put it in a nutshell, although this book is called The Last Werewolf and features a werewolf as its protagonist, mm-hmm. if it wasn't in the last analysis about or relevant to or resonant, you know, for human beings, there really wouldn't have been any point in writing it. So your caller's point about, you know, constantly trying to find new ways to evaluate good and evil and to figure out how we come to talk about it and what language we should use, that is one of the perennial concerns of fiction, full stop, of storytelling, full stop. Not just novels, but movies and, you know, drama, everything that's worth its salt, really, in terms of artistic endeavor. That's absolutely correct. We are, I think, novelists are always looking looking at how we are talking about good and evil, and whether we're still even using that kind of language. Mm. So, yeah, it's a valid point.
Glyn Duncan, please stand by there in Plymouth in the UK. You've moved beyond your seventh novel now, brought in a werewolf. We have a brand new fiction writer with us, with me in the studio here in Boston. Stephen Schlossman is with me, Dr. Stephen Schlossman. He's author of the new The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. He's a practicing doctor, a child and adolescent psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital, also assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. You can read excerpts of his book and Glenn's at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Schlossman, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think it is? Not necessarily, you know, step by step how you got into it, but the fact that you, a medical doctor in the year 2011, would be writing about zombies of all things. Why?
Well, I mean, I think just like Glenn was saying, I love horror genre. I love the movies. I love those Hammer films. I was so delighted he brought those up. I especially love the zombie movies, and the zombies themselves lend themselves more neatly probably than the other supernatural beings to a kind of medical explanation. You can sort of play around ideologically with them in a way that's a little bit harder with vampires or werewolves. They lend themselves more to the kind of romantic literature. Mm-hmm. The zombies lend themselves to this almost kind of scientific epistemologic examination.
Because they're just straight up horrible. They're not romantic. You don't want to snuggle with one. They just lope toward you, arms outstretched, and want to eat you.
Yeah, I think they are a great construct for modernity. They don't care. They're like drunk crocodiles. You know, it's like the guy who cuts you off on the freeway. He doesn't care about you. It ain't about you.
And in this, in your book, you've got on a half, two-thirds of the world has been consumed with a plague of people are becoming zombies. Like billions and billions of people are becoming zombies, and you've got the doctor figure on a little island in the Indian Ocean doing autopsies, trying to figure out scientifically what's going on here.
Right, and you know, using the word autopsy was a sort of play on words. I noticed on the website somebody wrote in to, on the WBR website, yeah, saying, "Wait, it should be vivisections because they're zombies." But
yeah,
you know, they're,
yeah,
the walking,
they're not dead,
right?
They're not,
so this is like the big thing.
But that's your whole issue.
That is exactly the issue I'm sort of getting at. How do you dispassionately conduct these scientific examinations on things that sure look like they used to be your mother, but they're not anymore? These shells of what used to be. And you know, we have a world that's frightened of a lot of things, of contagions, of global, all the things that you just mentioned. And I think the zombie genre sort of captures that well.
You're a psychiatrist. I mean, so you know those fears. Humans have always had them. It's not as, I mean, we're mortal. We live in fear of things since, I don't know, caves and big bears. But do you think the fear factor has grown in a way that draws us to this shadow?
I think it's, yeah, I think it's even more nuanced than that. I think, mm-hmm, I think certainly things are more frightening now, or we're more aware of what's out there that's frightening now than we used to be. But also I think we're just a lot less certain about what we hear. And that notion of, you know, what one of the callers just said, that person in the nice clothes might not be so nice. Mm-hmm. That shambling person might not be human anymore. That person might be a werewolf. We don't know for sure what we're looking at. And that's, I think, more unsettling than anything.
Or Glenn Duncan's werewolf, chain smoking and drinking scotch and a very witty raconteur, may suddenly leap up and chew your head off.
His hair was perfect, as the song says. Right.
Your doctor goes to the island to do the autopsy, vivisection, call it what you will. That means, of course, he's going to be infected and does become himself.
He does.
The zombie land.
He does. It's a sort of heroic sacrifice he makes for the good of humanity.
For the good of humanity, and it's going like crazy. Stephen Schlossman is with me. His new book is The Zombie Autopsy, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. From the UK, we have Glenn Duncan with his very well-received The Last Werewolf. Listeners, you can join us this hour. What keeps these genres coming back? How are they changing? What's your appetite for the danger, the lust, the blood, the werewolves, the vampires, the zombies? Is the Cranberries with Zombie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
With their tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns in your head, in your head, in your head, zombie, 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 what's in your head, zombie.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about werewolves, zombies, and the old fantasies, horrors, pouring into new fiction. Behind me there, the old theme from the Harry Potter movies, $6.5 billion they've grossed already in ticket sales. World premiere of the final movie in that long series, Thursday night in London's Trafalgar Square. But the books have sold 400 million and many, many more coming on behind, including some getting quite good reviews. Glenn Duncan is with us from Plymouth in the UK. His new The Last Werewolf, coming to the US, been out in the UK for a couple of months already. Stephen Schlossman is with me in the studio, Dr. Stephen Schlossman. His first novel is The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. We got a lot of response online here. Eric says on Facebook, can't leave out Amanda Hocking, the first independent author to sell over 1 million books on Amazon's Kindle platform, and did it by writing about vampires. Dan says, love the genre since reading Salem's Lot years and years ago. Lately, he's reading Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Mari says, in terms of publishing caveats, Anne Rice deserves the title Queen of the Damned. I read her first novel while living in the French Quarter of New Orleans, and it spooked me for life because I could actually walk the same paths as her fictional vampire antiheroes. She writes, werewolves never turned me on, but vampirism is something that does exist in daily life. Just look at Wall Street. Glenn Duncan, how did you choose a werewolf over a vampire? What's the difference in a novelist's hands?
I'm not sure. I think the werewolf had always appealed to me a bit more, partly because it's vampires have this debilitating business of having to sleep during the day, which has always struck me as an extraordinary weakness. And actually, just to refer back there for a second to the last comment you read out. About werewolves not turning this person on, I can kind of see that. But what always struck me about vampires was that they didn't have sex. That the bite and the drinking of the blood was always presented as a surrogate, as a sexual surrogate. Whereas the werewolf's relationship to libido was much more straightforward, shall we say?
Very straightforward. In your book, you've got a moment. I mean, your werewolf is tired of the whole thing. Werewolves, I don't know, they live 300-400 years, and he's halfway into it, and he's just tired of it, but every month it comes back. There's a little bit where it's coming on. The transformation is coming on. I wish you could read just a little bit for us there, Glenn, if you'd be good enough.
In my dreams, a small wolf slept inside me, and it wasn't comfortable. It moved its heels and elbows and paws, struggled to make space between my lungs, stomach, bladder. Occasionally, a scrabbling claw punctured something, and I woke. What were you dreaming? Arabella wanted to know. I knew what it was dreaming. It was dreaming of being born. The form and scale of its occupancy shifted. Sometimes its legs were in my legs, its head in my head, its paws in my hands. Other times it was barely the size of a kitten, heartburn hot and fidgety under my sternum. I'd wake and for a moment feel my face changed. Reach up to touch the muzzle that wasn't there. Days passed, and being awake guaranteed nothing. You hold a teacup or the rein of your horse, and there's your hand, your arm, looking just the same as always. But the mass is wrong, the reach, the grip. On the outside, it's you. On the inside, not. It's not you, Arabella kept saying. It's still me. But it's not you.
Glenn Duncan reading from The Last Werewolf. He's tired of being a werewolf, Jacob Marlowe. But he can't help it. Glenn writes in his voice, I keep telling myself I'm just an outmoded idea. But you know, you find yourself ripping a child open and swallowing its heart. It's tough not to be overwhelmed by the concrete reality of yourself as werewolf there. And Stephen Schlossman, here's how many billion zombies you've got going in zombie autopsies?
Oh, my goodness. So there's 3/4 of the population of the Earth. So we can do the math. Everyone's infected, in my conceit. Everyone's got the bug. It's more a matter of appropriate treatment to hold off the transformation to zombieism.
You've made an airborne infection here, so it can affect billions in a hurry.
I did. I broke the trope. So I spoke to a lot of folks, and it was really hard for me to get my mind around an apocalyptic scenario. scenario with just biting. I feel like we just round them up and let them eat each other.
Malcolm writes here online. He says, I think Simon Pegg, Shaun of the Dead, said it best in his afterword to The Walking Dead. While other monsters clamor for attention with capes and claws and bandages, the zombie has embedded itself into our consciousness with little more than a stumble and a moan.
Absolutely.
But your doctor is vivisecting to find out what?
Well, he's partly what's going on is that there's been some evil. We mentioned hedge fund managers earlier. I think one was eaten by the werewolf. In my book, the hedge fund managers decide to make a zombie plague and then bet on the market as it plunges. So then they also invest in the infrastructure to fix it, and they figure they got it all worked out. But like Frankenstein, going back to all these stories, these sort of hubris stories, it gets out of control. So they know there's an organism in there, and they've missed one. There's a bunch of organisms recombinantly mm-hmm. designed. They've missed one, so they're dissecting these zombies to try and look at each organ individually to find out what the organism is that they can then better prepare vaccines for.
All horror roads leading back to Wall Street lately. Joe in Milford, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that I'm approaching 30, and the reason these fantasy novels have become so appealing to me is because I grew up with video games, watching superheroes, everything else, comic books, and it's just one of those things where as I'm getting older and older, it becomes, not only do you have less and less time, but it becomes less and less acceptable to still partake in all those hobbies. But reading these fantasy novels, it's almost something to connect with people more so than just the tiny people that still play video games and stuff like that.
Right. So you can't play the video game anymore without being a little embarrassed, but you can carry around the book with the monsters inside.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's great. I love it. Joe, thank you for calling and read on. Colin in Burlington, Vermont. Colin, you're on.
Yes. I want to say I'm inspired by both of you writers. It's just wonderful stuff. My question is this. Back in 96, David Foster Wallace was talking about how the avant-garde had died, he felt, in literary fiction. And I was wondering if either one of you see this connection, that your writing seems to be using the avant-garde, the werewolf or the zombie, as the mechanism for kind of suspending our reality. And so I think as a writer, I'm curious as if you see yourself connected to maybe a new avant-garde.
Hey, I'll take it to Glenn Duncan first. Glenn, how about it? And does a werewolf help us suspend disbelief?
I don't see myself as being in the avant-garde. Partly because I'm not sure what that is anymore. But largely, I suppose, because the novel, The Last Werewolf, as I said earlier, very quickly became a novel about very basic human dilemmas and drives and conflicts. It's not so much that I decided to, you know, sort of marry the two things together, kind of perennial literary concerns with something supernatural or genre flavored. It's just that as soon as I decided to write about a werewolf, the other stuff got involved. It was an automatic thing. It's just that no matter what I set out to write about, these are the things that come out. So I think, I mean, I don't, you know, as I said, I think the avant-garde thing is perhaps a misnomer. I just think that there is an increasing tolerance for the blurring of boundaries and the sort of friability of these zones that we draw up. You know, this is genre, this is literary, this is, you know, this is one thing and this is another, and never the two shall meet. I think all of that is in something of a melting pot at the moment.
Well, that may be, but Dr. Schlossman, it seems as though in another sense, in every generation, there's some kind of key that sort of turns the lock in our minds and opens them up, makes them malleable, makes them ready to, you know, receptive to. And here, an awful lot of those keys these days look like you're zombies and werewolves and vampires.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess my first dilemma is spelling avant-garde in order to be able to own
right.
it. But, you know, to the extent that avant-garde literature has always been a way to create social commentary in displacement. So you can talk about the society, but in the kind of more comfortable place of werewolves, zombies, vampires, than if you were talking directly, say, a book like All the King's Men, for example. These are sort of dark times. They feel dark. They especially feel dark to the kids I take care of. And the kids I take care of are kind of romanticizing, especially the apocalyptic scenarios that come out of these books. So to that extent, I think there's an answer somewhere in the middle.
And these are children with psychiatric problems.
Correct.
And they're picking up on dark vibes.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, I had one, to give you an example, after a kid that I took care of had seen I Am Legend, the third iteration of that movie, the most recent one with Will Smith.
I Am Legend, yes.
He, you know, I said, so what did you like about it? And he said, dude, no homework, no making my bed, no girlfriends. It's just every day I set my perimeters, I get my guns, and I hold off the undead. That's it. That's it. Life would be so much simpler than all of this other stuff, all this – there was no Twitter at that point, but all this Facebook, all this email, nothing, no homework. It would just be easier.
And maybe sometimes we long to feel that way. Maybe sometimes we do feel it that reduced way. There's just a little bit from – if you could read from us here where your hero, Dr. Bloom, and he's been tracking this development of kind of a zombie plague, and he's watching its progression here.
Certainly. So he's watching the progression in one of the subjects that actually used to be a world famous virologist, but has since turned into a zombie, and he's noticing some of the anatomic changes: the robust heart, the functional hypothalamus, the reticular activating system. All these structures keep working. Our organs keep working because the virus makes them work. We get hijacked. We become the virus. The green sky, well, it doesn't matter. The dead fish, no impact. Viruses don't care about beauty. They don't care about art. They don't fall in love.
But they make billions of zombies in Stephen Schlossman's new The Zombie Autopsies. John in New Haven, Connecticut. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, John.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Schlossman. Based on your extensive knowledge of psychopathology, normal and abnormal development, concepts of mental illness stigma, how did that inform your novel?
It's a great question. So let me start first with the caveat. I take my work extremely seriously, and actually the research I do, the academic research I do, is exactly on issues of stigma and mental health, and, mm-hmm. and especially in the curriculum. The way it informed my novel, I think, is we tend to sort of think in an us-them kind of way, especially with regard to psychiatric illness. There's the folks who are sick, and there's the folks who aren't. In this world that I created, it's a kind of bleak world, but one of the messages is that we're all in this together. Everyone's got this bug. Everyone's fighting to sort of keep their sanity, to hold off the eventual progression and help themselves to get better.
I'm not sure your book is encouraging on that front, though, as the billions fall, become zombies and gobble one another up.
The hope is that the single man, the sort of ordinary guy, can sort of save the world. My hope is that they'll allow me to write a sequel to tell that story.
Yeah, well, that's always there. Glenn Duncan's already got that wrapped up. I think it's a trilogy in the works here and maybe a movie. Charles in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with a comment about transformation. It seems to me that we're so interested in transformation these days, from mm-hmm. self-help books to everything else, that there's an appeal to these kind of stories. We want to change drastically sometimes, and reading these books gives us a chance to kind of vicariously do that.
Yes, we may become bloodier and furrier or just hungrier, but it's definitely a transformation. Glenn Duncan, what about it, the urge to transformation?
Absolutely, and again, a very old and venerable one. You know, go back all the way to Ovid's Metamorphoses. So yeah, it's a theme of perpetual fascination for our species. I think, in terms of popular culture, I mean, Jake has something to say about this in the novel. He's talking about the extent to which people are no longer the opposite in a way of what your caller is saying, that people are no longer excited in the obvious transformations from man into wolf or sort of man into monster. But they are dizzily excited by home makeover shows and talent contests that specialize in turning non-entities into millionaires. So, yeah, I mean, I think this the different forms of transformation, how we're getting our transformation jollies these days, is interesting. I mean, the extent to which this is in popular culture now.
And speaking of jollies, I mean, there's no whether it's blood or sex or you name it. The Guardian reads you, and it says that you effectively say, "Here we go. This is a story about monsters. So let's see how much sex and violence you can take." And they write, "The answer is an awful lot when it's done artfully." I mean, you're giving very wide license to your crew here, Glenn. They really romp.
Well, again, you know, if you're going to do it, do it rare. You know,
yes.
I mean, we are talking about a creature that transforms into a person that transformed into a monster once a month, kills and eats people, and finds the whole experience deeply arousing.
What is Jake's favorite meal?
Well, let me try and avoid giving anything away about the plot, but effectively, the more emotionally invested he is in a victim, the finer the flavor.
Oh, heaven forfend. And Stephen, Dr. Schlossman, what about your zombies? They're the opposite. They'll eat anything that gets in their path.
Yeah, they are. You know, it's the other side of the spectrum. If something's going to end your life and tear your guts out, you'd like it to be personal. You'd like it to be about you, like it is with those werewolves. And I think what's so terrifying in zombie stories, especially the slow, shambling zombies, the ones that people like George Romero made famous.
They just keep coming.
And it's not even about you. You can eat a sandwich while you're running away. You can step to the side. And they'll just eat the next person's guts.
How does a zombie like to begin eating a person?
I think it's wherever they can get a firm grip. I mean, it's really that simple.
Oh boy! And for a werewolf, Glenn, does it begin with a swipe to the neck, or how does your Jake like it?
They're opportunists. I think rather like the zombies. I think they'll take a first bite wherever it presents itself.
Cigarette and a scotch after the meal.
Always.
Oh, boy. It's been fun. It's a big wave, and it's been fun to talk to the two of you right in the midst of it. Glenn Duncan, author of The Last Werewolf, joining us today from the United Kingdom. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
And Dr. Stephen Schlossman with me here in the studios, author of The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much. It was an honor.
We will go out with a little bit of course, Werewolves in London and Warren Zevon. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You hear him howling around your kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night.